This is the Saxo Market Call, daily insights on what is moving the financial markets.
Hello and welcome to this special edition Saxo Market Call podcast. We're recording this on Wednesday, May 12th, 2021, even though the release date is a couple of days later. Here in the studio with me, Stein Jakobsen, our CIO, and the topic today is inflation. Where are we at? Where is it going? And what are the implications from here for inflation? You know, there's, first of all, we have to define inflation, I guess, Stein. I mean, a lot of let me call it skeptical. I think it would be one way to describe your attitude towards the CPI. And I think it's a fair characterization of this very statistically created data series in the U.S. that ironically is also used for, you know, as a key metric for these inflation protected treasuries. One could argue whether or question how well those are inflation protected. You've encouraged us to look, of course, at things like commodities, but also shipping costs, last mile costs that are going up, and the semiconductor shortage could be driving some inflation in that space, certainly going forward. Where are we at, do you think, in the inflationary cycle? And where do you like to focus? Where do you think we should focus our attention in judging how big the CPI, the inflation pickup can get from here?
So I think we need to establish a few things. The reason why the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, is a horrible measurement is simply that 25% of the actual index is what is called rent equivalent. So you would expect a rent equivalent, which of course is the housing market's impact on your purchase basket of goods that you have to, you know, face on a year-by-year date, would be market to market. Actually, what it is a survey based, and it's very slow. So right now in the US, the real estate prices is up, depending on the state, between 15 and 20%. And this rent equivalent runs a 4. And if you look back in history, it's always been wrong. The second part is that the consumer basket itself has been changed so many times. And every time they change it, they reduce the component, the weight of what is going up in price and increasing what is going down in price. Of course, they are saying, well, it's a more technology savvy point of view. And finally, you know, do realize a 20-year-old, a 40-year-old, and a 60-year-old have very different needs in life. A 20-year-old needs education, a rental place, a lot of eating out and dining. A 60-year-old probably has a negative inflation impact from real estate because they own a second or third home. They may have some Airbnb returns. Actually, they have, you know, increasing purchasing power through owning real estate. So in other words, absolutely without any evidence. As an economist, then also let's point out there's really only one inflation number, and that is the GDP deflator, the difference between the what we call running prices or nominal prices and real GDP. That measures the total aggregate of the production in an economy divided by the price impact that creates the real effect. So, you know, none of these are available on a daily basis, so the market uses break-even rates. And fast forward to where the market is today, break-even rates in 5 years, which is now breaking 2.7, going towards 2.8, is clearly indicating that we are in a significantly higher interest rate, inflation environment than the Fed perceive it to be. Goldman Sachs has done an interesting study that says that break-even rates are almost always reached. So in other words, in 5 years, the inflation will be at 2.7, far above the level that Fed thinks is transitory at 2, 2.25. If it gets a little bit higher temporarily, they will be able to act. And then that is just an ironic sort of way because, and that is the real answer here, John, no one knows what inflation is. It's one of these things like welfare and other things that we talk about widely, never been really defined. It is the price difference. And by the way, it's not a precise science in like you need 2%. Folger, probably one of the biggest students of monetary policy in history, famously said, you know, in some environment economically, you need a low inflation and some you need a high. There's not a uniform best fit sort of equation to it. But what the market is signaling right now and going to the actual market itself, what is clear is that one, two, 3 weeks ago, the market was buying the narrative from the Federal Reserve that this was transitory. It was the base effect of the lower oil prices last year's whatever. Now the market is starting to price at least a 50-50 chance of transitory and that this is structural. I believe that the structural impact and the probability of structural inflation to be and remaining in place is now becoming the new focus. And hence we see that stocks that has a negative correlation with inflation, it starts to come off. And these are classically long maturity duration stocks, of course, and the bubble environment. And as you already talked to Peter about in yesterday's edition, something like green is some of those speculative names, Plug and Bloom is down 50% from the top. So we are seeing, in other words, a move from move toward quality away from junk. Junk being defined here as companies that have no earnings but have a great narrative or story to support them.
What do you think is the key driver here? Has it been this? Has it been this switch to a fiscal dominance, is what some people are calling fiscal focus? So we've seen this a really unusual mix of policy response to the pandemic. Of course, it was a no-brainer that we're going to go to QE again. The interest rates would drop to zero, but this. Especially in the U.S., but to a degree elsewhere as well, the massive cash drop onto society, that, of course, creates, with many of the lower income strata receiving that injection of funds, they have a high propensity to run out and spend virtually all of that. Is that the key driver here? And what's the potential for this to continue to grow? Because if the pandemic is out of the way, we've all got our shots, our vaccines, and some of the forward, suggestions for new infrastructure packages and so on have been sort of sold as being somewhat offset by tax raises for the high income earners, for some corporations, et cetera. So what is it that keeps the inflation engine turning over here and driving this, like we are seeing at the moment and what seems to be building at the moment?
So the big economic policy change that we've seen since the crisis, the great financial crisis in 2007-08, is that the central banks around the world now is pursuing a full employment mandate. And singly, that is the only thing they focus on. This morning, the RBA joined that very same new breed of thinking inside central banks, announcing that this is the same policy. And if you have a one-dimensional output that you're seeking, in terms of the policy from monetary combined with the now full tilt towards fiscal spend, then of course you create a unintended consequence of higher expected inflation and with it the higher marginal cost of capital. But what is important to stress is that that comes into the macro context of the political environment, which right now in the US wants to deal and solve for three generational challenges at the same time. The social injustice / inequality, the green transformation, and infrastructure investment overall. So three components, all of which is identified politically to be viable with the voters and with the political broad spectrum, but also which on its own, individually would have been a formidable task for anyone to deal with. Social injustice and inequality as one, green transformation. But we're doing it all at the same time. So we have central banks now fully committed to full employment. We have the political spectrum committed to these three challenges at the same time, which means that if you want to decarbonize the world, you are metallizing the world, if that is even a word. But you are going onto metal and the short supply that you see in the mining sector, and you are increasing the demand from this green transformation to a magnitude of 10x, 15x in terms of the demand on a sector that simply do not have elasticity supply to deliver. So in other words, John, what we're doing is that we are doing everything 180 degrees away from where we came from. And in my opinion, it's only just started. I mean, if you look into Europe, we have an election on the 26th of September in Germany, where the Green Party all of a sudden have become not only mainstream, but is also leading in the polls against the traditional CDU, CSU. And the reason for that is the demographic change that we see not only in Germany, but across the board, where the new marginal voter is someone who is under the age of 25. So the under 25 has grown up with aspiration of being green. The Green Party started as a protest party, became a project party, now is mainstream. And why am I mentioning that? Because on the 27th of September, if the Green do have an election, as the polls is indicating, they will change not only Germany overnight, but Europe, because they are more pro-Europe, they are more green, they are more anti the Russian and the connection to natural gas. The Nord Stream 2 will potentially be under a break. And on the fiscal side, they are against this Schuldenbremsen, the debt brake that sits in German constitution right now. So in other words, that I think these are all signals that we have a demographic change. Younger people is starting to have a real say in politics. You have a generation need to be more in tune with nature, and you have a need to move to electric vehicle, at least according to the political opinion. All of this puts enormous demand pressure on a supply cycle that cannot deliver. So, you know, and that's why we right now see in terms of inflation number, PPI numbers around the world, Denmark at 6%, UK at
7%. China at 6.8%.
China at 6%, so, and only just starting to rise. It probably will hit 10%. What is pretty sure, and it's been one of the themes from Peter Gardner, has been that, you know, and we said in Q1, commodity will be starting. The seventh commodity bull market is starting. And if commodity is going on, we are having, and supply constraints is the sort of the driver of these prices. What we'll see is that people will buy commodities strategically, and they will buy to for delivery, all of which is a marginal cost. And finally, in terms of how does a consumer or an investor see inflation, they only see two ways, is through the food prices and through the energy prices, both of which right now, food prices are up 30% according to the UN's FOA price index, and energy price because of the base effect is up 60-70%. So, you know, if we combine all this, we know that expected inflation is really what drives overall inflation, meaning that we are getting to 2.73% minimum. I think we are going to 4-5. And I think the actual inflation, if you decomposite sort of the structure of how people buy and what people buy right now, DIY, tools, lumber, getting delivery of your packages from China in terms of production of electronics, all of this is going up in price by between 20-50%.
That brings me to then, where are the risks and what the central banks and the fiscal authorities are hoping to achieve? Where is the risk here? And I think to me, it's a prominent risk that the Fed, for example, is making a policy mistake. Will the policy mistake prove to have been in the rearview mirror and over stoking the economy and financial markets with these very, very low rates and all the crazy pockets of speculative activity we've seen and frenzy in many cases? Or is the policy mistake come later because they realize too late that they've overstoked things and they have to course correct, which then disrupts expectations? So I wonder if there's going to be a really difficult path ahead of us in feeling out where expectations are versus what the Fed eventually has to do. What are your thoughts on that? What do you think comes next? Let's call it the next 12 months with this process.
So the high probability path I see for the next 12 months is the following. We will have higher than expected inflation, the catch-up effect, which will marginally drive the price of money up. So when we are done with the general account, the fact that the Treasury, the U.S. government right now has a huge amount of money sitting on the balance sheet of Federal Reserve, which they are now channeling into the real economy. In the real economy, the banks takes this deposit. The banks in the US right now has the lowest amount of lending relatively to deposits. And as the rules is, and counting wise, if you have a deposit from a consumer or a central bank, you have a liability. That liability needs to be met by an opposing purchase to a percentage term of the full amount of treasury. So we are capping the interest rate right now because this rundown of the general account.
And that ends around
August 1st. We're getting close to that level, but expect after August that we have an acceleration of the upside in interest rate, breaking potentially 200 basis point minimum in 10-year US government. What would that mean for the underlying economy? Well, we've said for a long time in our research that Q2 will be the peak in sentiment, the peak in economic data, will be the peak in valuation. Why? Simply because, you know, we had an economy that was not in real recession, but we had an economy that was totally closed down and then was reopened. a lot of economists, including myself, made the mistake of talking and addressing this up against the history of recession. This wasn't a recession. This was an abnormality, really. It was a binary sort of, now we are closed, now we are open impact. And of course, we needed to support people at the time in February and March. But as Stanley Druckenmiller, famously said, Stanley Druckenmiller has said on the Wall Street Journal article this week, you know, it's fine to do the emergency measures. When you don't have an emergency, why do you keep, as the Federal Reserve do, pretending that you are in an emergency crisis situation? And that, what does that mean when we combine all this together? It means that we are seeing slowdown of economic data. We're seeing a higher inflation, a higher marginal cost of capital, which will slow down the US economy to an extent which I deem to be so slow that the next policy response will be that the Federal Reserve will need to increase the purchase of QE, the amount of dollars they buy every month. And you will see another fiscal check. The fourth fiscal check will probably be in the mail for Christmas to make sure that the Christmas sales is good in the US. In other words, we're repeating the same mistake. So you can say your 12-month outlook that you wanted, the real cost to inflation and how it runs through the economy, whether it's transitory or not, we will know this by Q4, Q1 of next year. And then I think we will actually be trading at 4 or 5% inflation at a marginal cost of capital that will be slower than the inflation rise. But that means the margin at the companies will, of course, be hit very, very hard. And if you look at Q1 reporting, all of the major companies in the US are reporting high input costs and a need to sequentially and slowly take these prices to the actual end user in terms of the prices.
Is the Fed's policy mix here, when you look at that process and how you see it playing out, is the Fed's policy here something, you know, Druckenmiller labeled it irresponsible, labeled it crazy, but is this intentional? Do they want to over yeast the bread, if you will, as part of this attempt to re-engineer together with the handout attitude of the Democrats? Just you know, change the cycle, make sure that inequality, it gets addressed, that the lower end of the income stream gets their wages boosted, it changes the tables, if you will, on the whole system? Or are they just being too academic and just think we just have to have inflation up because we can't deal with this, the real level of legacy debt? I it's a question I certainly don't have an answer to myself.
I think it's a combination of all, but I think it's, this is the dream scenario for the MMT camp. I mean, Biden runs, Yellen is in the, directly or indirectly is in the MMT camp, because what they're arguing is that the fact that we could not through the QE program in 2007-2008 stoke the inflation means that the risk of seeing a catch-up effect or a fast rising inflation is very minimal. And they claim they have a tool to deal with. Mm. But what is interesting, and Dylan Grice made me aware of this, that like a lot of us, including me, after the QE program was initiated in 7 and 8, thought there would be inflationary. But in real terms, it was just an increase in the monetary reserve sitting at the bank system. So it was inflating the actual financial assets. This time is different, although, because what is happening is, if we talk about it, is a full employment focus and these three generation things at the same time. But in the context of being wrong, so Grice and me and a lot of other people was wrong in 7 and 8, but the MMT somehow thinks that they know better than Dylan Grice, who is, you know, just for the record, is a 10x more intelligent than I am, and Druckenmiller and me.
Just to interrupt, that it's a great podcast you mentioned. It's one of the unique podcasts out there. He was on macrovoices.com, Dylan Grice, where he, and you mentioned the same thing, just the intellectual honesty of looking back at a huge analysis mistake he made in the past and addressing and being open-minded about why it could. He's trying to make the prediction again, but why he could be wrong again, but why he still thinks it could happen this time, but for different reasons.
Absolutely. But I think what is really beautiful about the way he phrases it, that he was wrong. But, you know, if we were wrong, not understanding inflation, why is it the MNT crowd thinks they understand inflation better than we do? So in other words, going back to your core, the question is Fed right? Or are they wrong? And why do you think what they think? They are doing the same mistake we did in 7 and 8. They think they understand inflation. And to be honest, I've been around this market since the 1980s. I still don't understand what inflation is, to be fully transparent. And inflation, again, is an elusive term. It is price changes, but price ranges of what exactly? So I think what this really, and Dylan Grice Macro Voices interview sort of distilled it to me. I mean, I'm honest about the fact I can't predict whether inflation can be high. I can just see I'm so involved in so many business people around the world through Saxo Bank, and all of them are reporting 20, 30, 50% higher prices. I have to believe that these business people knows better than me. So the bottom up is feeding this information about higher rates. When I look, and if I have any expertise in the world, it is to do the macro scenarios. The central banks are, you know, by committing to full employment, the politician by committing to these three generational challenges are committing fully to what they do, meaning that next time the stock market is down 15, 20%, they will recommit with a larger check, with more easing, and with more commitment to thinking they got it under control. So in other words, what will happen is similar to in the 1970s is that when we look back at the 2020s in 2030, we said, where the hell, pardon that for the use, but how, where the hell did all this inflation come from? You know, and we will say retrospectively, well, it was expectations of it, because you know, you as a consumer, you already know now that your delivery will be 3 to 4 weeks slower. You know the price, the marginal prices are. So you're fully willing and able to pay that price because that's what you do. So in other words, whether the CPI monitored or the PPI or any inflation measures, what is happening in your mentally, psychologically is that everyone is now accepting business people, everyone but one branch of people, which is the central banks. They are still in denial because they have been underperforming on inflation. So it's a little bit like a trader who's been burned by buying technology stocks. He's never going to buy technology stocks again. I think to some extent, it's very understandable the central banks have this position, but their ability to predict is worse, as I've said many, many times, than my golden retriever.
And we're also interesting that the U.S., since the global financial crisis, the U.S. balance, the private balance sheet is actually in its best shape it's been since then. An interesting starting point for this new cycle.
And as Druckenmiller points out, the retail sales, the mm-hmm. nominal amount of retail sales in the U.S. today is significantly higher than it was pre-COVID-19.
Yes, definitely, because there was record rises in personal income because of the cash drops.
And if you response. Ignore that as a central bank, it is at your peril, because you're really making a huge mistake about the strength of the economy and where it comes from. And as you are willing and will continue to be willing to commit to full employment and transfer of income to the social injustice and inequality that happens in the world, you are dictating that their disposable income and retail sales will continue to fly. But you're also saying, and by the way, when we look into the next 20 years, we're going to be doing green transformation, a massive amount of free schooling or whatever, which by the way, for the record, I'm fully for, because of course that is the ultimate productivity gain that you can create in society, but it is, you know, a build-up phase where you have to invest before you ripe the fruits of it.
All right, now let's round out the discussion here in the podcast with hedging against these developments. What's the trade? What is the portfolio hedge if one is generally just passively long stocks, for example, indexed to the basic outcomes there? I think I think we've already alluded to it. I think the differentiation within the stock market is going to be massive for the cycle because of the implication of the interest rate sensitive sectors that have been way outperforming since the COVID lows, relative to of course equities that can adjust their prices relative to income, inflation pressures, etc. So equity market, and then there's the shape of the yield curve, and there's Fed funds, and then there's commodities. Let's go through first. Stocks, if there's anything further you have to say on there, and then the yield curve.
So, you know, I think, and we have to make an advertisement for Peter's Basket's way of looking at the stock market. And we said in Q1, as I already said before, that commodity-linked companies would do extremely well. And it is the best performing basket we have right now. But inside that, we also have, you know, the ability to buy volatility. And I know a lot of listeners have been questioning, you know, the access to, it's a complicated Bible. So, but Peter came up with this new
cost of carry
and the cost of carry, not least, but Peter came up with this financial index, which have a lot of traders and the likes that are in this business also involved in crypto. And that is one neat way of actually increasing some exposure into that financial traders index. And just look at Peter's webpage to see that. I really like that from a personal view, because you have these businesses that benefits whatever direction the market takes on volume. And they are also encapsulated into this new crypto growth that I see coming in terms of not only Bitcoin and Ethereum, but the broader base third generation crypto. So I really like that sector. I like logistic for the obvious reason. Logistic is and it's been a favorite of mine in my portfolio for a long time. The UPSs, the Deutsche Post, the Haugel in Switzerland, the DSV in Denmark, the new names. So I'm so old, I can't even remember the new names. But but all of these standardized sort of companies are doing extremely well that delivers. And then clearly, sometimes you need to time. So I said before, the green transformation sort of index is down 50%. But don't forget, this is not going away. It's a repricing because of the inflationary and the cost of capital. But ultimately, some of them are viable businesses. There's a Chinese, the biggest solar panel company in the world is down 60%. China has to be by 2060.
To be fair, that's because it ramped 400-500% probably before that drawdown. So there's some of it's a consolidation relative to maybe just over frothy speculative phase, right?
But people want some part of the portfolio to be speculative. And I think what is happening is that people are migrating out of sort of the platforms economies, the platform internet things, and over to some of these things that lives in the real world. I mean, these green companies need to deliver a real product. We can, and I know you are very strong on opinion on this, but whether they can actually deliver the real product is a different thing. But there will be speculative forces in there. And in the fixed income space, we have been long TIPS. And a lot of people say to me, especially on the institutional side, why would I buy TIPS with a negative interest rate? But the fact is that the price mechanism of TIPS, of course, compensate in the portfolio. So yes, you're actually getting upfront a negative interest rate. But you know, don't forget, price-wise, inflationary bonds can go negative 400 basis point, which means your price goes up, relatively speaking.
Because one unfortunate thing about them is they're linked to the CPI, which we've already criticized. So, but some of the CPI, some of the inflation has to go and feed through to the CPI. So there has to be some level of inflation protection by owning these things. If, as you say, CPI is set to go to 4-5%, then that coupon is going to look, or the total return is going to look very different versus a nominal treasury over the next 10 years.
But in the 100-year portfolio, we have 20% in real estate, which for the record has done extremely well this year. And of course, why do you like real estate? Because it is index linked. Again, it's only the CPI, but at least you get the CPI and they're doing extremely well. Some risk if the marginal cost of capital goes up, but we have 20% in that. We have 5% in volatility. We have 7% in crypto. We have 7% in TIPS. So that's kind of what is unusual for our 100 portfolio relatively to the normal mix of fixed income, commodities, and equities overall. We don't see massive need to adjust, despite the fact we are not seeing a huge return. And I think what's interesting about the stock market for the next 12 months would be that, of course, you can make money in the stock market because there are great companies at all times, but it's going to be the different set of companies that make money, as we like to call it, the quality over the junk, meaning people with and companies with margins and ability to maintain margins under pressure from inflation. And interesting enough, most of these companies lives in the real world. So it's also the story about intangible versus tangible that is coming back.
There's also the regulatory threat, which I think we can agree is quite massive for the huge platform companies. And there seems to be the global minimum tax initiative. There's also the regulation and risk even on the breakup side. It looks like there's a pretty strong anti-trust team developing under the Biden administration. That could be interesting as well.
Absolutely.
And on just briefly on fixed income and the Fed funds, how long do you think the Fed maintains its this insistence on the 2024 liftoff timeframe? I mean, that's so far over the horizon. We're talking about the scale of inflationary pressure potential here in the near term. I mean, I don't want to put you on the spot on a date, but is the June FOMC meeting in play? Is it more likely maybe something kind of hint at Jackson Hole? What do you think is the how that shapes up and how the market absorbs that? Just as the final sort of question.
Tactically, the Jackson Hole is what the Fed prefers as a venue to create new directions in the policy. But I think in history, Fed has been famous for saying one thing in one meeting and then being 180 degrees away from that point because of the condition changing. So, I mean, we have to give them credit. It's constantly saying that we are data dependent and we are flexible. So they have the flexibility in the narrative of doing what they need to do. But I think if I'm right about inflation, we are talking about the end of 22 already. So almost 18, 24 months before the Federal Reserve sees them themselves. And you know, just look at the forward rates and where the market is. And maybe, you know, for those who can do optionality, buying a, you know, 23 December euro.
There's some interesting ways to do option structures in the euro dollar short term.
Maybe we should get Altea to look at some of these things for publication on the website for the listeners to go into. But I think it's one of the biggest, in my 30 years of doing this, I think this is one of the biggest mismatches between how Fed sees the world and how the market sees the world. And generally opposite what people think, it's not Fed who will reign supreme in this. It's always the market that this dictates ultimately.
The market will tell the Fed what it's going to do at some point.
It will, and the Fed over the last three chairmen and chairwomen has become more dependent on the market than the other way around, simply because the policy is so one-dimensional. And the measurement of the policy effectiveness is really the stock market index.
Right. All right. We're going to leave it at that. Hope you enjoyed it and have a great weekend out there. And of course, we'll be back to our regular program with the daily podcasts next week.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter at Saxo Market Call or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.